ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I wonder what made in Australia means to you. Is it a source of national pride, a matter of economic security, or a badge of quality? Maybe it's all three. I wonder what made in Australia means today. Do you think it means the very best quality there is? It was once, I think. In recent years, we've seen some serious shifts in what we manufacture locally and who owns those systems of production too. So how do we get there? How do we get here? And what does the future hold? My guest tonight is Professor Simon Vill. Simon is Emeritus Professor of Economic and Business History at the University of Wollongong, Research Associate at Harvard University as well, internationally recognised historian and Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. He's the author of a new book, Global Enterprise in Australia, International Business Down Under Since Federation. He might have seen a bit in the course of his researches. Simon, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you.
That's terrific to have you with us. Pre-Federation, of course. Can we start at the beginning? Right at the very beginning, there was no manufacturing. Stuff just came in ships. It was unpacked. And I guess, you know, a ship from the home country was eagerly looked to see what might be in it. Pre-Federation, though, Australia, as the colony progressed, it was a British colony. What did the British like to have us manufacturing in those years anyway?
Well, as you say, we were manufacturing very little, and we were relying upon the arrival of ships from the UK for, you know, basic manufacturing type of goods. I mean, obviously, daily needs like food and clothing and, you know, construction materials like timber and those sorts of things, and perhaps also a few special small-scale craft industries, books, glass, jewellery, those sorts of things. That was about it. There was no large-scale industry in Australia in the early 19th century.
Yeah, we became more of a manufacturer, yep. I guess, is what the nation's wealth and access to capital improved, did it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, as the size of the population grows in the second half of the 19th century, as we're attracting more foreign investment from overseas, then we do get, you know, the emergence of more manufacturing in the first place. We get factories, so there's clothing and textile being produced, the processing of primary industry products, so, you know, sugar refining by CSL, meat refrigeration by a range of Australian and overseas companies like Vestey's and Borthwick and so forth, and dairy production as well. And, you know, on top of that, we also get the growth of metals, machinery, engineering, you know, boats and wagons and railway carriages, those sorts of things that an emerging country needs to connect and to develop. Mining equipment, of course, also very important by the second half of the 19th century. Hmm. And for growing urbanisation, obviously building materials, production of gas, those sorts of things. And so we find in the second half of the century that manufacturing share of GDP accelerates quite significantly. So, you know, manufacturing as such, we can define it in 1850, was about 5% of GDP.
Right.
By Federation, it's 13%. So, you know, we're seeing significant growth there. And, you know, you also see the emergence for the first time of industrial or manufacturing suburbs, so, you know, Collingwood or Balmain or Redfern, those sorts of places with, you know, a widening range of manufacturing occurring. And indeed, just to sort of round that off, one thing that I think is really interesting is that the biggest, you know, business enterprises in Australia at the time were basically the colonial railways, you know, the public railway companies. And so they had a demand for large-scale manufacturing, which, of course, was particularly making carriages, rails, and increasingly, particularly after Federation, locomotives as well. So you get something like the Eveleigh Workshop, which, of course, has gone through various periods of change and development, and today is a, you know, interesting example of renovation and reimagination. Mm. They were big manufacturing plants for the 19th century, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 people employed and plenty of capital equipment.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the economics of importing things and sourcing it from other markets and all of that was different then, wasn't it? It was more cumbersome. I mean, Britain was a great manufacturer, of course, throughout the 19th century, into the 20th century too, for that matter. And presumably, the rise of Asia as a manufacturer hadn't happened. European manufacturing, but Britain as an attitude towards its colony never particularly wanted its colonies to become sophisticated manufacturers anyway, did they? They'd much prefer to export raw materials, which English factories, could make into sophisticated goods and send back to them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, the complementarity is significant. They're happy for Australia to export, primary products, foods, mining ores and so forth, which could be then used in British industry, and in return those manufacturers would be sold back to the, empire countries like Australia. So definitely that's the case. And, we've seen that pattern grow up over a long period of time that, Australia, above all else, has been an exporter of primary products. And that may be partly because that's what Britain wanted, but also that's because that's where our comparative advantage has lain. We have the climates and the land and so forth to produce large amounts of food and, of course, the mining resources as well. So there's a certain inevitability about that complementarity.
Yeah, kind of made economic sense as well. George in South Australia sent me a lovely couple of pictures as well, saying how times have changed. In the 1960s, he said, all of my family's household appliances were Australian-made. And he's got pictures of a Kingsley radiogram, a Healing television set, a Ferris portable radio. Yeah, I had a Ferris one stage. A Silent Night fridge. Yep, we had a Silent Night fridge. A Simpson Ringer washing machine, etc. They were all made here and all regarded as reasonably high quality. I'm thinking you say it was 13% as a percentage of GDP after at the turn of the century. The kind of the highest it ever got was around 28 to 30%, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. By about the early, mid-1960s, the manufacturing share of GDP peaked at about, as you say, 28 to 30%, depending on slightly different types of measurement. I mean, a lot of that is, you mentioned my sort of recent work on multinational enterprise. I mean, a lot of that is also the result of the arrival of overseas manufacturing firms. You can see the opportunity to produce in Australia because there wasn't much of a manufacturing sector, and also, exporting some fairly bulky manufacturing goods, I mean, automobiles and household durables and so forth. So, we get the motor companies like Ford and General Motors. We get, electrical companies like Philips and producers of fridges and all sorts of household goods, or companies like Electrolux. So, they're coming from the Netherlands, they're coming from Sweden, they're coming from Britain, they're coming from the United States. So that manufacturing sector gets quite a big hit from sort of the arrival of multinational enterprises.
Yeah. I want to get to motor cars and the influence of the multinationals a bit later, because it occurs a bit later. But I remember reading the history of particularly the 1890s and the big recession, of course, that occurred. Then it was an economic disaster for Australia. But the same arguments that we have today were being trotted out then too about, why are we buying things from overseas? And I remember the Bulletin magazine had a famous picture of an illustrated tagged picture of a bloke wearing the latest fashions. And, it was tagged saying, the trousers were from San Francisco, the shirt was from Boston, the hat was from somewhere else, and the shoes were from Britain. Why aren't we making all these things here, said the Bulletin, because, they were very protectionist, weren't they? So there was, even then, and this has persisted throughout the debate in Australia, there was a strong protectionist element that said, why don't we protect the things we make here, and then we wouldn't have any of these nasty imports which are job replacing. That argument was just as strong then as it is now, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And before Federation, the different colonies had different views on protectionism. As you probably know, Victoria was protectionist and New South Wales wasn't. And then, of course, when we get to Federation in 1901, what are we going to do? And, not surprisingly, the protectionists won the day. So, as you know, and we're probably going to talk about it, we get tariffs from 1908 onwards, and asserting those sorts of things. Why should we be buying overseas products when we could be making them ourselves here? So that argument has continued along for a long time.
Yeah, it did. How did the tariff start? I mean, we rehearse all these arguments with the current Orange administration in the US, of course. But how did the argument start here? Was it a general tariff across the board, or was it targeted to specific industries? And how great was it?
Yeah. So good question, or series of questions there. So. The focus was obviously on manufactured goods, because they're imported goods that they're focused on. And, you know, there was a certain amount of targeting as well for, you know, I mentioned EV before the 1908 tariff, the first tariff. Typically, locomotives were imported from Britain, which, you know, in itself, when you think of the logistics of importing them, why did that ever happen? But then, you know, the tariff goes up and they can see that the best thing to do was to manufacture them locally. So, you know, it has that impact. And so the first tariff that comes in is 1908, the Lyon tariff, and that begins to introduce protectionism, which is then increased over time. There are several other tariffs, the Green tariff, and then finally the Scullin tariff in the early 1930s.
In the 30s during the recession, during the Great Depression,
absolutely. And I think all the way through that, there's a debate that has a certain resonance today. And that is, you know, what should we be importing? What should we be manufacturing ourselves? Should we have a sort of a broad, diverse economy, which is, you know, is contrary to the strict economics argument of comparative advantage, where you produce those things you're best at and import and trade on that basis. And that sort of argument is coming back to hit us quite a bit today, isn't it?
Because, Yes, it is.
Should we go back to refining more oil? Should we, you know, continue to smelt aluminium, even though it apparently is not productive? How do we balance the economics of you know, comparative advantage with the politics of geosecurity?
Yeah. Yes, I'm talking with Professor Simon Ville, Emeritus Professor of Economic and Business History at the University of Wollongong, about the history of manufacturing in Australia. We've talked about the 19th century when most of the stuff was imported into Australia. But after Federation, you know, the Australian economy becomes more sophisticated. There's a lot of gold money, of course, in the back half of the 19th century. And along comes the First World War. I imagine, Simon, that must have really concentrated minds massively, did it?
Because
they might have thought, hang on, we've got to equip all this, we've got to equip an army, we're on our own a bit. There's no imminent threat of invasion, not in the First World War, but we have to think about these things. I presume politicians thought a lot about Australia's manufacturing capability, did they, particularly in defence?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously there's a bit of a shift, as is in any war, towards, you know, focus on heavy industries and those sort of relevant for wartime. And also because during the First World War, and again in the Second World War, foreign companies in Australia that are, you know, from, if you like, enemy nations, are sort of disbanded. And suddenly we realise there are certain things that these companies have been doing that which we couldn't do ourselves, which includes smelting.
Yeah.
And so the Australian companies, Broken Hill South and the third one, I think, as well, established in 1915 Broken Hill Associated Smelters, because they no longer could draw on the Germans to smelt their iron for them into iron from the ore. And equally, BHP begins to produce steel in 1915. So, and of course, that then has had a much longer life, of course, of BHP. It's all changing now, of course, it's BlueScope. That's had a much longer life, but those were both affected, because after the First World War as well, they began to realise that, in fact, we didn't have a military capability. Doesn't that sound familiar as well?
Yes.
And by the Second World War, we were much better equipped to produce munitions and, you know, military-style equipment than we were in the First World War, which is a different type of war as well, of course.
Yeah. All right, Simon Deville, Professor Simon Deville is our guest tonight. He's had a sore throat all day. I'm sure you wouldn't mind me saying that, Simon, because so thank you for manfully ploughing on through the history of Australian manufacturing. I'm sure we did manufacture cough drops at some point. Maybe we still do. In fact, I'm sure we still do. Someone's texted in saying, evening, gentlemen, we have a fridge manufactured in 1972 with the original Kelvin Adamator still running. 54 years old. Yeah, look, I should just mention in passing here, everyone thinks that we don't make these things anymore, but I for certain have a fridge which I bought 15 years ago, still going, and it's a Kelvinator, I remember, I think, yeah. But it was made in Australia. I don't think they're made here anymore, but it sort of limped on the appliance business. But we'll get to that in a moment. During the Great Depression, because this is an historical journey, Simon, as well. it's during the Great Depression, of course. Well, everything's kaput, isn't it? And by this stage, of course, Australia is a great producer of agricultural products, and particularly wool, for example, which is in big demand and becomes in even bigger demand after the Second World War. And we do manufacture here, don't we? We do process the wool here, and we, you know, card it and make yarn out of it, and so on, don't we?
Yeah. We do. Of course, we're also major wool exports today. Most of that goes to...
We don't do it anymore. We just basically send the stuff overseas now,
That's right. But, well, I mean, the wartime impact on wool exports, of course, was remarkable, because the Australian wool exports became what we call a monopsony of the British government. In other words, the British government bought the whole of the wool clip for about 4 years in both wars. And they also paid generous prices for it. And when they bought more wool than they needed in the end, a lot of it sat in warehouses in Sydney and Melbourne, never actually made it to the UK. And at the end of the war, we were allowed to sell the wool for a second time, if you like, in local auctions. So it was a generous prices. So that was a big impact. But yeah, the interwar period itself in manufacturing is very interesting, because obviously we think of that as a period of depression. But, you know, there is revival in the 1930s, and it is the growth of the period of consumer household white goods for the first time.
Uh-huh.
So we get the spread of electricity, which is a pretty important precursor in most places.
Yeah, well, that is the thing, isn't it? Because there aren't really any consumer goods so much for houses before electricity arrives, because there aren't any appliances.
There are
mangles for the wash house, and coppers to boil the water, but they're not machines. The manufacture of a washing machine is a thing that arrives only with electricity. That's later.
Yeah, that's right. There is some, interestingly enough, there are some slight deviations from that, in terms of fridges at least, in that those rural areas that didn't have electricity until after the Second World War, it's a generalisation. Electrolux, for example, produced quite a few Kero gas fridges.
Oh, yeah.
And then the 1950s, and they went over to. It was sort of quite a nice example of a foreign manufacturing firm that sort of had a sense of what was needed in Australia. And then, you know, so it's all those white goods. You also get the growth of branded goods more and more as well, you know, branded food products. You've got Nestle and Cadbury's here, and you've got obviously IXL and Arnott's, and, you know, domestic companies as well, all beginning to take much more seriously the notion of branding, selling their good, not so much in a sort of, you know, generic sense, but branding, heavy advertising going behind it as well. So there's actually quite a lot going on in the interwar period in terms of manufacturing in Australia, despite the, the economic downturn.
Yes, exactly. Professor Simon Deville, I want to keep calling you Deville, but you're not, you're a Ville.
Yes. That happens a lot.
I bet you were a Deville in your family history at some stage, probably. Simon is a professor of economic and business history. We're talking about the history of manufacturing in Australia. 1-300-800-222 is my number. You can text me 0467-922-702. Give us a call. You could give the professor a chance to rest his voice as well. John from Batemans Bay. G'day, John.
G'day.
Hi.
I was just ringing you. I was born in Collingwood in 1941.
Yep, Collingwood, Victoria. Collingwood in Melbourne,
Yeah, Collingwood was a massive manufacturing area. Just about every second block had a factory in it.
Yep.
And big ones like Fairfield Hats, Dunlop Tyres, Ring Grip Electrical, Cyclone Wire Fencing, AWA, and umpteen clothes factories. And just about all your mates had a parent who's worked in a clothing factory or in a factory. So it's sort of forgotten now. Many of those factories are now turned into posh
posh apartment blocks because unaccountably, John, Collingwood's become a groovy place to live. That's right. How did that happen, John?
I don't know. We fought it. We fought the migration when it first started arriving in the 50s. It was pretty bloody, actually.
Yeah.
And then we learned to live peacefully.
Yeah.
But, Collingwood bore the brunt of that, and now it's a very sweet, pretty place.
Yes, it is. Yeah, you say you live peacefully, except when you're up against Carlton, to be fair. To be fair here, John.
There's only one football team, and that was made in heaven, and that was Collingwood.
Yeah. Thanks, mate. Good on you. Thanks for raising it. Bye-bye. Yeah, no, but it's true. And, of course, in all the big cities, I mean, Adelaide was a huge place, wasn't it, for particularly metals manufacturing, manufacturing of all kinds. Someone's texted in saying, we will get to cars, but what about the Lightburn Zeta? It was a car made in Adelaide. And Lightburn, of course, was a washing machine company. So Adelaide was a big manufacturing centre. So was Melbourne in the inner city of Melbourne, of course, and also, for that matter, Sydney as well was, all the way from the CBD all the way out through to the airport to Botany Bay were manufacturing plants everywhere. 1-300-800-222 is the number. So this goes on particularly after the Second World War, Simon. I don't think explosion, but I mean things continue to grow, don't they? Right through until the mid 60s. What's happening with tariffs at this stage? They continue to get higher, don't they?
They do, and they sort of peak in the early 1970s when there's a big change of face on policy. But yeah, so on the one hand, we can say, was this the heyday of Australian manufacturing? And, it's the largest share in GDP that we ever see. But in some ways, there were problems as well because the tariff had become so high that, the argument against protectionism is that it protects companies from, serious global competition.
Yeah, it makes them inefficient because they...
Exactly. And it's generally regarded that's what had happened, that we were paying higher prices for our wonderful Australian products than if we'd been importing them. And this came to the attention of quite a few people, not only the economics profession, they believe in comparative advantage, but also the OECD, which produces important, it does its annual economic survey and it produced an important one. I can't remember the exact year, it's about the late 60s, early 70s, where it basically makes this point quite strongly. And, hearing it from the outside rather than from people in Australia, I think had quite an influence. And so there is this change in policy in the 1970s and 1980s. So that we had got, I think the figure is off the top of my head, that by the early 1970s, our effective rate of protection, this is averaged out, was about 35-36%. And effective, we mean taking account of the fact that when you reduce tariffs or put tariffs up, it affects the competitiveness of the costs of domestic manufacturers as well as the benefits or disadvantages for imports. So basically that got up to, very high tariffs, not as high as Donald Trump's tariffs, but still pretty high.
Yeah.
And so the policy changes, so begin in the 1970s to reduce tariffs, and that goes off the next.
There's an argument, becomes an equity argument in the 70s and 80s, doesn't there? They say, well, look, hang on, the textile and clothing and footwear sections, which had very high tariffs and also tariff quotas. I mean, you couldn't even import as much as you wanted under a tariff. You had to buy a quota as well, which was a real protection heaven. And for that, and people were saying, look, hang on, this all this does is make shoes and clothing expensive in Australia. If we, and that goes straight to the to the, you know, the cost, you know, the cost of living, the quality of living of lower income people. So poor people are paying for these jobs, and that argument had a lot of sway by that stage, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, and also there was a political element to it as well, because there was a feeling that there was a bit of a, you know, a deal going on between some of these manufacturers and the coalition governments at the time, you know, that was to the disadvantage of everyone else, if you like. So that was a key issue, and you know, it comes back to this question of you know, what are your choices? Do you want to pay more but create more jobs for Australians, or you know, do you want to go back to more a scene of comparative advantage where people pay less, and maybe the money that's saved by individuals in not paying high prices can go to other areas of economic activity and create jobs for people elsewhere?
Yeah, exactly. Tell me about the arrival of multinationals, because we talk about the car industry, and this is a thing that pains many people, and I understand that, you know, because it's an industry that spawned so many other industries, you know, in all the parts suppliers and the wheel rim manufacturers and the tire manufacturers and, you know, door handle manufacturers and so on and so forth. It's not just the assembly of the cars, it's all the bits that go into cars, and this had spill on manufacturing ripples all the way through the economy, and so the collapse of it, of course, had major effects on employment and capability and know-how too. I've remarked many times, why don't we make an electric car in Australia, because at least we know how to make one here. and there's still a lot of expertise around. But the car industry was an example, and there are others, aren't there, of a whole manufacturing sector that was created by multinationals with government tariff support. They weren't so much homegrown. We talk about Holden as a homegrown industry, but it wasn't so much, was it?
No, not really. I mean, you know, Holden really only becomes a serious manufacturer in the 1930s when it goes into an alliance with General Motors, of course.
Yeah.
So Holden were originally just coach builders. I mean, the whole question of the car industry, what's happened to it and where it's gone and so forth is a big question here. I mean, you're quite right in what you say, that it's an industry that, if we could choose one industry that's born of multinationals, it would be the automobile industry.
Yeah.
There are a few sort of hobby cars built before then, but it really starts in 1909 when Ford import, if you like, for complete flat packs or whatever you want to call them.
Of
the T, exactly right. And then you have these, you get it reported in the newspapers quite a bit that half a dozen of these arrive and there's a workshop in Melbourne or anywhere across the country in many ways, and they're all there sort of putting together the car. And so that, you know, that is obviously not in any sense manufactured in Australia. It gets a bit more serious after the war in the 1925. Ford have their first assembly plant at, of course, Geelong.
Yeah.
But rather interestingly, this assembly plant is the location of a previous wool warehouse of Dalgetty, and you know, one of the earliest models is called the Dalgetty for that reason. But it's an interesting sort of transition here from a domestic wool industry to incoming motor industry. So you know, that progresses, and then you know, General Motors and Ford are there. The big change is the completely locally manufactured car, which occurs, of course, with the 48215, the GM Holden after the Second World War in 1948, and this, you know, everyone's probably seen that picture.
Everyone's very proud of it, aren't we? And rightly so. Becomes who's PM then? Chifley, isn't he?
The famous picture of Chifley with the first car. It's the first car off the line or not, but obviously one of the first cars.
That's right. Wasn't the FJ? Was it? No. What was it called?
I think it was the. I have them freely. It was called 48215, but I may be wrong on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get that, and of course you get all the Japanese cars. Toyota comes across and they make quite an impact. And Toyota are quite interesting. They start producing here in 1963, and they are an unusual example of a company that actually later on, the 1990s, uses Australia as its base for production and export of, and the particular model, the Camry, which we all know,
yeah,
of course,
yeah,
which was exported across Asia and the Middle East, probably other parts of the world, I'm not sure, but certainly in those localities. And they alone accounted for more than half of car exports from Australia. And so, you know, that decision, which has been so uncommon amongst multinationals, to say, right, we're basing our production here in Australia and exporting elsewhere.
But I mean, in the same way that the arrival of car manufacturing was a decision by multinationals, I mean, these were decisions made in Detroit. The departure of car manufacturers was also a decision made by multinationals, wasn't it?
Yeah, no.
I mean, governments said, look, we're not prepared to keep paying money into this. And they essentially, well, they were going anyway, weren't they?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the question of why has there been a, you know, decline and fall, if you like, of the Australian automobile industry? Right. It's got several factors. I mean, one that is a domestic factor, if you like, is the decline of the tariffs.
Yeah.
So that protection for domestic,
which at that stage was some hundreds of percent.
Yeah, it was large. It was large. So that made a big difference bringing that off.
Yeah.
But you also get other things that multinationals are doing. They are reassessing where they do their production. So instead of saying, okay, we're going to produce in Australia for the Australian market and in Thailand for the Thai market or whatever else, they began to think a bit more strategically about global specialization of their production and focusing their production on those countries where labor costs were lowest and where the domestic market was large. Yeah. So that tended to hollow out car production straight. And it had a hollowing out effect for a number of other manufacturing industries as well, because we just couldn't compete in terms of cost and in a scale industry with other.
The argument always was, wasn't it, as things got worse during the 80s and the 90s, that prior to the departure of the multinationals pulling a pin, as it were, that, you know, why doesn't Australia become a manufacturer and export cars to the world? The trouble is, this wasn't really a national decision for Australia, was it? This was the issue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It would be a substantial subsidy to persuade those companies to go against their to do that. And, you know, governments in Australia have often, you know, offered large sums of money to try and keep production here, not just in automobiles and many other things. We've seen it recently, of course, in the aluminium smelters and so forth. But, you know, is that trade-off? Is it worth doing?
Yeah, a lot of people would say, yes, it was. What do you think?
I think you take it on a case-by-case basis. This whole question, if you like, if you take it in those terms of, the current government's policy of, you know, do we have a bigger domestic manufacturing sector? I think it's difficult. You know, we can see the economic reasons why we can't compete in scale industries like autos and consumer durables and so forth. But there are, Australia's still, you know, exports manufactured goods. I think it's not a lot. It's about 10%. So it's still.
Yeah, the sector used to be 28%. And what is it now?
Yeah. Between 5% and 10%, basically.
Yeah.
But I think there are things that, you know, we can think about more clearly. You know, I think it's not so much about scale as it's about being smart with our manufacturing. So, you know, you think of some of the successful companies we've had in recent years, like Cochlear and ResMed, and Orica and those sorts of companies. I mean, they're all doing, you know, smart manufacturing, if you like, and they are generating exports as well. So I think, but it's not at scale. It's not, you don't have to have a big manufacturing plant to do it. So, you know, that makes a big difference. And I think the other area where we do pretty well and we could continue to do pretty well is in the mining industry. So, you know, mining is a multinational industry, which is, you know, predominantly located in Australia. We have a lot of the knowledge and the skills and the innovation that we don't have. You know, we're not a centre of the car industry and all that innovation and knowledge that's shared amongst firms that are.
But we are in mining, yeah.
But we are in mining,
and yet absolutely. We do so little downstream mineral manufacturing processing. That is, and
we do.
You know, and this has been a missed opportunity, hasn't it? Surely.
Well, you know, again, it is a scale thing. I think where the mining issue is important is in this group that's called the Mining Equipment Technology and Services. There are loads of manufacturers there. Some are Australian, some are overseas-based They produce a lot of high quality equipment, including exports that, you know, we do well at, and we could do more. I mean, I mentioned Orica just now. That's a you know, a good example of an amazing Australian company that, you know, started out in the Victorian gold rushes in the middle of the 19th century. I think at one point it was acquired by Nobel, then ICI, and you know, it's now this continues to be an important, influential company. So I think, you know, we have got opportunities, but we have to try and work out how we get this trade-off, the question we started with at the beginning, between a pure economic view of manufacturing in this country and one that takes account of geo-global security concerns.
Yeah.
You know, it's come out again now, of course, with the U.S.-Iran war, the petrol, the oil shortage.
Yeah.
And refining's gone. It's only gone in fairly recent years. It's gone. So, I know.
We make very little of what we need to run our everyday life in here in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of people are very concerned about it.
Yeah, absolutely right.
1-300-800-222 is the number. Simon Deville, Professor Simon Deville, is our guest tonight, Emeritus Professor of Economic Business History at the University of Wollongong. We look in the history of manufacturing in Australia and what went wrong and what might happen as a result. If you'd like to join us, 1-300-800-222.
Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Yes, Sharon joins us from Ballarat. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for this really interesting topic. It actually, this topic comes up every single time I ever go on a drive with my brother.
Yeah,
because he grew up, he started off as a toolmaker originally and went on to other things. And his dad, our dad was one. And so we lived through the heyday of manufacturing. I've got a Holden / Toyota built in the 90s that will outlast me.
Yeah, I'm sure it's right. I'm sure that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so my question is, we're seeing the same things happened in Britain. We're sort of parallel in what's happened to us. And we've seen efforts over in America under Mr. Trump to his tweaking all these tariffs. He's not sort of back jumping. He's actually got strategies to try and build up get back great American manufacturing, such as John Deere. He told Mexico, you can't be manufacturing in Mexico. You've got to do it in America to the company, right? So I'm just wondering, it's an absolutely massive job. If we don't have government that have the will to do anything, maybe what we can do is tell the politicians that this is what we want, and if you can't come up with these strategies, then we won't be voting for you. And so my question to the professor is, I know you can't, it'd probably take hours to explain it all, but is it possible to simply explain to us, if you had a strategy, what would your strategy maybe be
to increase the level of manufacturing? Okay, all right. Let's put that to Simon. The thing is, you know, do governments have leverage in this space? Because manufacturing requires access to capital, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does, and it requires access to knowledge and innovation as well.
Yeah.
And so you tend to get clustering of industries. You know, it's a sort of the corridor effects that you get in innovation.
It's why computer chips are made mostly in Taiwan, for example, or why innovative computer stuff is mostly in Silicon Valley. That you get collections of expertise in one spot.
And that's exactly right.
And we haven't done that very well, have we?
Well, we're a long way from anywhere still, despite the, you know, all the communications we have.
Yeah.
A PhD student of mine that finished his PhD late last year used this term knowledge towers, which basically means it's ideal to base your manufacturing around a sort of area where there's a height of knowledge, a lot of knowledge, which is the same sort of idea as clustering, with a slightly different sort of, vision there. And I think that's a problem. I mean, we clearly do have it in mining, you know, and that remains a major industry. maybe we
that's,
don't.
That's true. But even the mining industry, most mining companies are not Australian owned, are they? They're owned by a combination of big multinational companies, BHP included.
Yeah, they are. But they operate to a large degree in Australia. I think it's
sure.
if you have enough firms gathering together, irrespective of whether they're sort of Australian owned or foreign owned, you'll get this benefit. And we've got that benefit without any doubt in mind. And you've got all this, you know, a long time ago the mining companies tried to do everything themselves from sort of beginning to end and everything in between. And now they really just concentrate on a few core issues of actually mining the product. All the technology and everything that goes with it is often given out to highly specialist firms, which is why we've got this huge METS sector. And so, you know, it's a classic example of clustering. And, you know, we actually do quite well there, but, you know,
It's in a lot of those big industries which I think puzzle many Australians, which is, you know, for example, why on earth couldn't we be a major steel manufacturer, given that all the iron ore is here, all the coal is here, we've got energy to do it. You know, we don't have any transport. I mean, all the stuff is here, and yet we didn't seem to be able to make it as cheaply as Japan when we had to ship all the iron ore and all the coal to Japan, and they could make it and send it back to us more cheaply.
Yeah, that's true. Well, maybe that's an area we could do more in, that sort of downstream production from ore extraction. That is a possibility.
Yeah. Steve from Carrigbar. G'day, Steve. Hello.
Yeah. G'day, Phil. How are you?
Pretty good.
I was responding to your request to ring up and save the poor Simon his voice for a few minutes.
Yeah.
So I'll give you my story, and then before I pose a question to both of you. Yeah. I left school in 73, sixth form, and for 8 years I worked for Sunbeam at Campsie.
Oh, yeah.
They had the offices in Troy Street and the manufacturing factory.
What were they making there at that time, Steve?
All the appliances, every Sunbeam appliance.
All those Sunbeam appliances.
Yeah. Oh, there was so, and everyone, all the foremen in the factory had been there 35 years.
Did they make that fantastic toaster there?
Yeah. Oh, amazing toaster.
That amazing toaster that lowered the toast into the
sandwich maker.
Yeah.
Everything.
Every time I do talkback on this, it's the appliance that has lasted the longest, that toaster.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I've still got one that works.
Yeah. No, I'm not surprised. They go for 20, 30 years.
and also they had a repair plant. If people, something went wrong under warranty, they had a plant at Mascot where you'd take the appliance and they'd fix it for you free of charge.
Yeah.
And, I was there for 8 years. Malcolm Fraser was the Prime Minister, I remember, at the time. And all of a sudden, we merged with Victor Lawnmowers at Milperra, which was another Australian gigantic factory. But then the next year, Sunbeam and Victor were bought by a Taiwanese billionaire.
Oh, yeah.
And he closed down both plants and took everything to manufacture in Taiwan, which is where all the Sunbeam and Victor went at that time in the 80s, early 80s, mid 80s, I think it was. My memory's a bit hazy. But I was just going to ask Simon and yourself, could Malcolm Fraser have done anything to prop up, because they were employing thousands of people in those two plants, to keep that manufacturing here?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, in terms of that general question, it's not as though governments weren't wanting these industries to stay here, was it, Simon? Could they have done anything meaningful to stop the exodus to cheaper cost bases, countries overseas?
Look, I think, as you said, that they did make an effort to try and keep companies here in production onshore. But, you know, I think that particularly when you get the movement of some of these assemblies and factories to Southeast Asia, you know, proximate to the Australian market, lower costs, big economies of scale in their domestic market, I think then, you know, governments have to make a decision about how much money they're prepared to put forward to you know, subsidize these industries. You know, I think when we talk about to what extent are we going to sort of compromise the sort of so-called economic requirements of comparative advantage, I think we have to think about which industries are important to us. You know, I mean, though it's lovely to have Australian white goods, if you like, it's not strategically important. What, you know, what's important in terms of, you know, some of the things we've been discussing recently? Yeah. Should we be having more oil refining?
We should have more oil refining, surely, more steel making, more smelting. I mean, smelting's vital.
So I think we have to be, you know, government policy has to be targeting those industries where we can make a difference, where it does matter to us strategically, you know. And that's, you know, that's the same sort of debate that came up after the First World War and the Second World War.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe in COVID to some degree as well. And now we've got another, you know, uncertainty that we certainly live in an era of global political instability. And we have to be very conscious of where we put the line between economics and politics.
Yeah. Steve from Caring Bay, you'll love my texter, who says, I still have my Sunbeam Mixmaster from 1964. Deborah from the Grove says, I've got a working Speedy electric knife from 1980. Good on you, Deborah. You must be the only person in Australia who thinks an electric knife's any good, though. They were a useless appliance, weren't they, Deb? Anyway, look, it's an interesting, I mean, one of the things, some takeaways, I suppose, here, Simon, and time's beaten us, but we'll have to go, but is that these arguments are not new. These arguments have always been with us from the beginning, from the turn of the last century and the century before that. Good to have your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And I think you're right. That's why history is very valuable for
us. Of course.
You know, these things have been done before.
Yep, they have. All right. We'll have to go, but thank you, Professor Simon DeVille. Professor Simon DeVille has been with us.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.